Good morning and welcome back to the second day. So as Mary said, this morning we're talking about our work with national standard setters, and in particular what we are hoping to achieve is to have a discussion about the work that some national standard setters and also regional bodies are doing, both assisting us in the standard setting process and also the work that they're doing to help us support implementation and consistent application of our standards. It's going to be a little bit of a discussion between ourselves, and if I manage the time well, we'll have time at the end for questions, so please do send questions in. Now, just to give very brief introductions, I looked at Michelle and I said, I don't seriously have to introduce you, do I? Surely everybody knows who you are, but I could tell from her reaction she expects me to introduce her, so... If you don't yet know who Michelle is, it worries me somewhat, but Michelle Sansom's down the end there. She's a member of our technical staff. She does a lot of different things, but I think the most relevant hat she's wearing for today is looking after stakeholder engagement, so that's why I'm a bit worried if you don't know who Michelle is. And she's going to start off this morning by just giving us a few minutes introduction about the role of national standard setters to set the scene. Now, moving along from Michelle, I'm going to introduce the panellists on a first-name basis because they're my friends, but also because I don't want to upset them by mispronouncing their surnames. So first, we have Philippe. Now, everybody wears several hats, so I'm going to talk about the hat that I'm asking them to wear for today's panel discussion. So Philippe is the chair of the Mexican Financial Reporting Standards Board, but today he's in particular wearing his hat as a member of GLASS, the Latin American Standard Setting Body. Next to Philippe, we have Andreas, who today is wearing his hat as the president of the Accounting Standards Committee of Germany. He is, of course, also vice president of EFRAG, but he's going to be wearing his German hat today.
Thanks very much.
Linda, next to Andreas, is the chair of the Canadian Accounting Standards Board. And next to Linda, we have Washim, who works for the Chinese Accounting Standards Committee. But today, the particular hat we're going to ask him to wear is as head of secretariat of AOSSG. So welcome to all of our panelists. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Michelle, who's going to set the scene.
Thank you, Sue. So yesterday, Mary explained that this conference, our theme is about preparing for 2020. And in the next hour, as Sue said, we want to highlight some of the work that national standard setters undertake in the standard setting process in developing IFRS standards. So I want to start by going back to Hans's slide from yesterday. Hans outlined that 2020 was going to be quite busy, and that there are 9 major consultations that the board is planning to consult on next year. And of course, there'll be the individual consultations about amendments as well. Hans also noted that in previous years, over a quarter of our comment letters had come from national standard setters. So I hope, as head of stakeholdering, in my role of working with national standard setters, that we're here today at the conference because we believe in globally accepted high-quality standards and working together to achieve that. Now, this isn't a new theme because in 2004, the conference discussed the role of national standard setters, and the conference concluded that national standard setters to take an active role in the board's work and work together as national standard setters. But since 2004, the ISB's work and the application of the standards has grown. There are over 66 jurisdictions in the room today, and the conference remains one of our key events for working with national standard setters. But the question remains, how does the board engage with over 140 jurisdictions that apply IFRS standards? And we do this with your help. Firstly, in your role as direct stakeholders, you are the experts in financial reporting and in the standard setting process, and we need your assistance in this way. But we also need you as our eyes and ears. Sue often talks to sharing the love. And when understanding what's happening in your jurisdiction with your engagement with stakeholders in your jurisdictions is also vital to us. So if we look at the board's objective, a single set of globally accepted standards, to achieve this, we require and need your help to have new, revised and amended standards adopted. And this is after full adoption of our standards. The continual process of adoption is important to us. To have high-quality standards, we need high-quality input. And to have enforceably globally accepted standards, we need to be capable of understanding what's happening in jurisdictions. And this is how we work with you together to support each of these stages. A single set of globally accepted standards. By working alongside us as standards are developed, national standard setters have a unique insight into the board's thinking as it develops its standards. As standards are issued, you are the knowledgeable insiders. You've often watched the board's thought process backwards and forwards, observed the board meetings, and understand the debates that the board has had. But we also work with national standard setters after we've issued the standards or during the process of standards, and many board members attend regional meetings or individual meetings, and more recently we've done a lot more work by working remotely with you. And in addition to that, Sue outlined the education materials that we try to make available to standard setters. But to have high quality input, we really do need you to be our eyes and ears on the ground, the conduit for local reviews. This provides us with really important insight, especially when we're preparing effects analysis for new standards. We need to understand the local challenges. In having enforceable and consistently applied standards, it's really important the relationships that you have in your jurisdictions to help us support that. Whether it's working with participants before the standards become effective, or whether it's working through and helping with regulators and the larger audit firms on the issues that arise, maybe putting those issues forward to the Interpretations Committee or discussing issues with staff, all of that is really important to us. So as Sue said, in the next session we're going to ask our panellists to help us explain some of the work they undertake as individual national standards setters in some of the regional groups, and also how they work with some of the focus groups for looking at specific standards.
Okay, thank you, Michelle, for setting the scene. So, Andreas, I'm going to pick on you first. Firstly, looking at participation in the standard setting process, I very much believe that not all of the good ideas come from our office. We really rely on national standard setters to be our eyes and ears on the ground to make sure we understand local issues and you can help us develop high-quality standards. So I guess from your side, how do you engage with stakeholders in Germany to develop the responses that you send to us on our consultation documents? And how do you work out who the key people are that you need to get involved to, you know, give the best German response you can?
Thank you, Sue. I think my first point would be that we don't wait for you to publish a document. So as you said and as Michelle outlined, we follow the standard setting process very closely. Our staff members, we have usually staff assigned to each of your projects. And we rely on our staff actually alerting us in the leadership team if something comes up that, let's say, it looks odd.
And sure, that never happens.
No. But looks odd doesn't just mean there's a technical flaw or something like that, but it could also be that the board is proposing something that looks odd to a German audience because it is different to what we used to do, or it is not how we perceive the words to be read. And it is in these instances that we then get together, think about it, and if we believe that there is something that should be brought to your attention, we actually just pick up the phone or write an email instantly and get in touch with you. Now, that happens, I would say, really on a bilateral basis. That's between the Secretariat of the German Standard Setter and the IASB staff or board members. As the project develops, I think we have an understanding as to who might be impacted the most. from the preparer side, from the user side, and from the audit side, obviously. And then we usually try to get in contact with those particular people that we feel are probably those that have most pronounced views. So I just pick one example, rate-regulated activities. Whilst that certainly is an issue for Linde and in other large countries, it barely affects us. There's about one company, and we know everyone in that company by name. So to get a high-quality response, we probably just pick up the phone and ask them, what is it that you want us to say? And we just bounce that then off and see, does that tie into other concepts, to other views that we have submitted before? And I give you then another example. Obviously, over this summer, we were quite busy in drafting our response on the IFRS 17 amendments. And we got a bit of a challenge here. I mean, finding the right constituency is very easy because it's the insurance entities. However, if we just lend our ear to the insurance sector, our response would have been drastically different. So we saw ourselves a little bit as the gatekeeper also in making sure that we are not just advocating what the industry wants, but also bouncing that off under other industries, other perspectives, long-standing views that the German standard setter had. That's not to say that we can't change our view, but we want to make sure that we are consistent and that our messages that we gave yesterday tie into the messages that we are giving then. So in a nutshell, I think it is a continuous process, and we don't wait until the ISB really publishes something, but we try to be influential as early on as possible.
Okay. And is there anything that you would do of note that's different between responding to a discussion paper that's more broad and sort of exploratory versus an exposure draft, which starts to look more like, you know, specific wording proposals?
I mean, we as a standard setter probably not. Let me phrase it that way. It's far more difficult to get people's attention if you discuss a discussion paper because it's so, the final product is so far way down the road. And it's often so high principles that people can't really relate that to the groundwork that they are coping with every day. So I think if we want to get people's attention, we probably have to do some extra work in peeking ahead and say, well, this principle to us reads like these three concepts. And if you apply that to that German concept, to that German instance, to that industry practice, this is what it would mean to you. So we really need to do some translation work and bring it from principle to groundwork so that people actually relate to it. There are some projects, obviously, where this is far easier. Primary financial statements, I think everyone has a view as to should there be subtotals, yes or no, should there be non-performance measures in the income statement or not, should there be a reconciliation, so that's easy. But if you come to something like FICE, where you sketch out a new theoretical way of articulating a principle, that's new to everyone, including us, but it's certainly so for the majority of our constituents, and then we have to really do some translation work.
And probably particularly important for us because it's always best to get the input early in the process, even though it's hard to get people's attention because it's hard to steer a different course later on when suddenly people realise they should have been watching before.
Right.
Now, just to try and morph slightly into specifically looking at comment letters, and I think we've got a question. I'm looking, gazing, I'm not sure who's in control of the process here, gazing in the direction of Roberta. Oh, thank you, Roberta. So there'll be a Slido question asking whether you have participated in or written a comment letter to the ISB in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Even 3 weeks, maybe.
Yeah. I can't remember.
And while we're waiting for that response, maybe Andreas, I'll warn you what I'm going to ask you next, because you're not off the hook yet. Mm. And that's when you're actually sitting down to write the comment letter, how do you, you know, work out the most effective way to write a comment letter that makes Sue Lloyd sit up and listen and has the most influence and is, you know, the best source of communication for developing a standard?
Mm.
So let's just look at the poll. 80%, so that's good.
Yeah.
Yep. It's going down. Come on, some more yeses, please. Stop, stop. Not too... Probably, yeah, it's probably about right, I guess, given that we've got a very broad spectrum of stakeholders in the room. So, but that's good, and we do appreciate all your letters. Okay, so effective comment letters, Andreas. You're a details man, so I'm sure you've thought about it.
I'd say it depends really on the type of exposure document. And if you do have a very confined amendment on which we comment, we try to be as specific as possible and try to point you directly at where the pressure point is. If we address a major standard-setting project or a discussion paper, then we try to be as helpful as possible, and that is obviously a vague phrase. What I mean by that is that we try to, firstly, A, not upset you, get you interested, but also make clear that if you hear criticisms from us, they are meant to be constructive in a way. Now, in order to do that, obviously, we need to give you some ideas as to where we believe the right direction of travel should go. And I might again turn to our most recent response. So I didn't have my Slido on, but I certainly wrote a comment letter, or we wrote a comment letter just recently, actually several of them, but probably the most important one was that on IFRS 17 amendments. And I give you an idea of what I meant in responding to two questions in particular. One, both of the answers were unsolicited answers because you haven't asked us for. So in that comment letter, in the ED, you asked, I think, 10 questions. And obviously there's always that catch-all question, are there any residual comments or whatever? And even if you don't ask that question, we take it as granted and we'll comment nonetheless. So where there is an issue where we believe that the board has done its thought process, but we believe that the arguments should be weighed differently, we try to be more specific in the sense that we first follow your decision process as we have understood it, and at some stage you might have come to the crossroad where you turned left and we believed you should have gone right, and here are our arguments. And then we try to go argument by argument and say, we don't think that argument holds and here's why. And here's our argument, and this is why we believe it travels better than your argument. So in our comment letter, and I'm not going to do a big marketing campaign, there are some answers where we actually spend more than a page and become more or less very detailed and tell you our thought process. There are answers also where we say we believe that the direction of travel that the board has taken is good and it goes in the right way. However, we believe that you've stopped short. And our main argument there is that there are other transactions where the principle, like for like, should apply. So if you have similar or the same transactions but in a different form or shape, the accounting should not be different. And we just stop there without telling you, do this, do this, do this, do this. Because we just believe that, especially with these amendments, probably in a particular situation, you are better equipped to actually say how much of that extra work you can afford and squeeze in the remaining time frame. But we just tell you, you called about 30% of the population, and you could go anywhere between 30 and 100, but we just say this would be the key principle that we believe should be applied, and then you take it from there. So our response in terms of is it helpful or not, we hope it is helpful because we try to sketch our idea, and the more remote our ideas are, the more explicit we become.
Okay, thank you. Now, before I move on to consistent application and implementation, do the other panellists want to add anything that they would think about differently in addition to what Andreas has said in terms of developing responses to us for the standard-setting process?
Linda? I
just want to say first that you didn't tell me which hat I'm wearing, so I'm really confused about what I should be doing up here. Just joking. Well, I don't wear hats well, so it doesn't matter. My staff would tell you that, but anyway. One of the things that we really work hard on and focus on is once we've determined that we want to suggest something else, we actually test it, not only to see if it would work in Canada, but will it work globally. We feel very strongly that we can't just say this is what would work for us and throw it over the fence at you, because you need to deal with a whole bunch of jurisdictions. And so I think that is one of the special things that we try to do at the very end, saying, and we don't always know, but we try. And we think it's important that everybody tries to do that if we're going to have global standards.
Philippe or Shane, do you want to add anything on this subject?
I think mostly, I think the similar things with Andres mentioned, I think our stakeholders will follow these projects very, very closely. And one thing I would like to add is because in China, with so many stakeholders, they are very keen on the IFRS. So about this step, I think from Ministry of Finance, we would like to translate these papers into Chinese version to help them understand the new requirements and the big changes. I think that will be very important for them, because not every stakeholder they could read this English version, even though some of them, no problem.
Philippe, I'm going to come back to you a little bit later and ask you specifically how you draft a comment letter from a regional perspective, because that's even a layer of additional.
Yes, but perhaps in this question about effective comments, what we have done is to anticipate the topics. Once we learn that the IASB is in research stage, or when they have a topic to discuss, then we inform. And the people start thinking about the problem. For instance, in the leases standard, we started discussing this 5 years ago. Okay. And that is something that has been very, very helpful, because to coordinate in Latin America, 16 countries is difficult. Then if we do not communicate the news on a timely basis, it's difficult, it's quite difficult.
Thank you. It's very interesting to me, the amount of pre-work that's gone on. I've never thought about it. So I learned something this morning, so that's good. Now, Linda, wearing your Canadian hat, just to be clear, moving on to implementation and consistent application, as everybody, I think, knows, that's a key strategic focus for the foundation to, not just write words that are applied around the world, but to write words that are applied in a consistent manner around the world. Now, I know that Canada does a lot of work in this space, but I think it would be really interesting to hear from you how you've thought about the development of structures and processes to support implementation and consistent application in Canada, and also how you make the call of when something needs to be sent to the Interpretations Committee and where you think you can deal with it domestically.
Thanks, Sue. So I think the best way to talk about this would be to describe the evolution of our I4S discussion group, because that is our main tool. Just for those of you who don't know the Canadian structure well, we have a board, and then underneath that board we have a series of advisory committees. It's not unlike some of the structure that the ISB would have. And one of our key advisory committees is our I4S discussion group. And that group has been in place since 2009. When we originally formed that group, prior to our transition to IFRS in 2011, we actually wanted to have a forum where people could talk about some of the common issues arising from their work to transition to IFRS. But what that did initially was put a bias on that group that we could only talk about standards that were already effective, because of course we were adopting all of the effective IFRS standards. And then there was another unwritten rule, and again, this was before I was the chair, that said, well, we can only talk about issues where the big four have come to a consensus, because we don't want to stir up any things, and we don't want to pretend that we're issuing any kind of interpretive guidance, because we've always had a very strict rule that only the ISB can do the interpretive guidance in through IFRIC. So anyway, we had this group, and what we did was we identified common issues, and we talked about these issues. And the important thing about this group meets in public, And so people have access to the discussions. And in today's world, we actually live stream the group so that people don't have to come and observe it, but they can hook in through their computer. And so that group has morphed a few times. And in today's world, what we do is we talk not only about standards that are currently effective, but we bridge that gap. And now with the implementation of IFRS 9, 15, 16, we started changing so that we would actually talk about standards before they were effective, because we understood with these big standards, people were having a lot of trouble in terms of implementing new, big, complex standards. The other thing that's important is that in Canada we have a few very, very large companies, and then you drop down and we have most of our public companies are medium and small sized. And so those types of companies don't have big accounting policy groups with technical accountants, and they often need more help. And so we look for common issues where people were having a lot of trouble. And so some of those issues that we might have considered would have been things like on IFRS 9, we looked at things like the classification of related party loans, because that seemed to be giving people a lot of trouble. IFRS 15, and actually we ended up talking about 20 issues about IFRS 9 before they were public, or before it was effective. IFRS 15, we talked about a bunch of issues, including things like variable consideration, et cetera. And often we talk about the intermingling between one standard and another standard. So in that case, we were looking at an adjusting event under IAS 10. And 16, so far we've talked about 20 issues, and often variable lease payments come into play, or the term of the lease or onerous leases come into play. And so it's been a very interesting process. Now, what's interesting about the IFRS discussion group to talk about how we can work together globally, since we've gone live streaming, we've kept a track of our statistics for the last few meetings. And starting back in June of 2018, about 13% of our people coming in on the web were from outside of Canada. And then that went up to 25%, and now it's kind of settled around 20%. We're looking at jurisdictions, the U.S., France, Hong Kong, Brazil, the UK, Philippines, there's others, but that was some of the regions. And so it does actually show you how global we've become, because the notion of discussing these implementation issues has gone global. And as well, what's very interesting, we can tell who's on the websites. We can tell, because people have to sign in to do the live streaming, one of the parties that often shows up would be securities regulators in other jurisdictions. So it becomes very interesting in terms of what they may be hearing in terms of our application versus others. The group itself is very widespread. It has preparers, auditors. We have a couple of regulatory folks who are observers. And we actually have an observer who is a member of the IFRS Interpretations Committee. And so what we're getting is a better linkage between the work that our group does and how we would then elevate those things potentially to IFRIC. In order for the group to actually send something to IFRIC, it has to come back to the Accounting Standards Board. And the Accounting Standards Board will discuss the issue, make sure that in our view it actually meets the criteria for a submission to IFRIC. And then we would gate it, put it on our letterhead. The letter would come from us to IFRIC. And as Sue knows, she's gotten a few love letters from us recently in terms of things that we would like to see. Things like cryptocurrency, cloud computing was one of our favorites. And the reference to cannabis yesterday. Okay, yes, it was us, but we didn't actually say cannabis. We said IAS 41, so.
But we knew what you meant.
Yeah. I just want to be clear, okay? I often say that if I have to talk about the reporting for cannabis much more, I'm going to need some soon, but anyway. What we try to do is make sure that we've got all these key linkages. And the other thing, do you want me to talk about TRG for one second?
Yep.
Okay. So the other thing that we do is when the IASB has a transition resource group, we form a Canadian transition resource group. And then if we have a Canadian rep on the IASB's group, that person is also connected to our transition resource group. So I'd like to pick revenue. We had a telecom executive who was very familiar with all of the big changes that were coming. Her company was very affected by IFRS 15. So we would have our own transition resource group in Canada. They would meet, talk about all the issues that were going to be discussed at the ISB transition resource group ahead of that meeting, so that she was informed not only for the telecom industry, but all the other industries that might be affected by these issues. So that when she was in London talking about the issues, she had the benefit of getting all the input she could from across the country in Canada. So the whole idea about implementation is to involve people at an early stage, even before the standard is effective, talk about common issues, and then give awareness to those issues. And the last thing I'll mention is we have a searchable database. So every issue discussed by our IFRS discussion group is on our website, and it's a searchable database. So you can go in and put in keywords. It'll come up with every time the group has talked about that issue. You can read the transcript. You can read the report from that issue, or you can listen if you're so inclined and you have wine in front of you. You can listen to the audio tape of that issue, so you can listen to the actual discussion that took place. So all of those things, we hope, not only help our implementation efforts, but they could be helpful to others in your jurisdiction, because all you need is a computer and then you have access to the information.
Well, I know where some of the UK hits for your group are coming from.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, we often have the staff. If the staff know we're going to talk about an issue, they can pipe in, the ISB staff can pipe in via call. In fact, in our last meeting, I guess it was last week, we had two issues that we discussed with them where they were able to call in and listen to the discussion.
Yeah, which is helpful, particularly when issues end up at the committee. It's useful that we can refer to the discussions that have already taken place. Do your other panelists, do you have something you want to add on the work that you do on consistent application and the transition resource groups? No? In the interest of time, I might move on then, if there's no burning additions. And I'm going to now switch to talking about one of the regional groups, one of the important regional groups, GLASS, quite a well-established regional group now. And I'm always fascinated about the process that must go on behind the scenes to reach a regional view when these comment letters are sent in to us. Very helpful for us to have that pulled together in one letter. So I wondered if you could give us a little bit of a picture of what goes on behind the scenes to get to that point.
Yes, of course. The Group of Latin American Accounting Standard Setters, GLASS, was created in 2011 for the purpose of presenting technical contributions to the IASB with respect to all exposure drafts, all is important, exposure drafts and discussion papers issued by the IASB. Therefore, GLASS aims to have a single regional voice before the IASB. Notwithstanding the above, all countries maintain the right of national standard setters to individually respond to consultation papers issued by the IASB. And that is because our trustees and our stakeholders request every country to respond. Not all of them do it, but some of us do that. In addition to the GLASS response, we present by country response. GLASS includes 15 Spanish and one Portuguese-speaking countries. All but one of them apply full IFRS for listed companies. Most countries permit the use of IFRS for PMEs, for SMEs. Sorry. In some cases, it is mandatory to apply these standards for non-listed companies. Since its creation, GLASS has responded to over 70 consultation documents sent by the IASB, including exposure drafts and discussion papers, all of them. And before that, and we at this point we have several documents in process because we still have time to send our response. Before GLASS, very few countries responded. That is important. Now everybody is involved, and at least they learn what we are doing as a region. In order to develop common letters to send to the IASB, we have established a due process that requires creating a specified technical working group, the TWGs, that's what we call it, for every exposure draft or discussion paper published by the IASB. All country members have the opportunity to appoint at least one member to participate in every technical working group. And normally the persons who are appointed is because they are familiar with the topic. Insurance is different than financial instruments and of course leases and the others. Each standard setter represented in the WG undertakes different tasks in the respective countries. For instance, surveys, discussions with technical groups, contact with preparers, regulators, analysts, and auditors. All results are summarized, and the summary is used as a platform for the TWG discussion paper. The technical working group discussed the various points of view included in the summary during several conference calls. Sometimes for us it's very difficult to comply with the exposure draft term because we have to translate to Spanish the documents, and that takes about 15 days. We have excellent support from the translation group, but sometimes it's difficult. For instance, the IBOR with 45 days was quite difficult, but we responded. We responded on time. The tool develops a final document on the basis of the agreed open responses and the technical opinions of its members. Finally, the documents are submitted and approved by the GLAS board. We have a specific meeting for that. In the consultation process, each country obtains responses from technical groups belonging to professional and entrepreneurial organizations, firms, and academic institutions. Regulators are also involved in this process. Once the comment letter is sent to the JASB, we publish it in the GLAS website in English, Portuguese, and Spanish, and additionally, we send it to all country members for its distribution in their jurisdictions. With this, we ensure that countries who do not participate in one technical group at least learn about the comments, and that has been very helpful. GLAS holds 4 face-to-face board meetings every year in different countries, and during which we organize technical seminars to discuss and promote the implementation of IFRS with the aim to improve the quality of reporting based on IFRS standards in the region. We also hold virtual meetings every month using Skype or other technology, and that has been very easy and very helpful. Each jurisdiction develops its own strategy to involve users and other interest parties in the understanding and implementation of new international standards. For instance, in Mexico, the Mexican Financial Reporting Standards Board has created several groups of experts, such as a transition group for IFRS 15, a transition group for IFRS 16, which in Mexico has been a little bit difficult to apply. We also have a group of experts on financial instruments composed of representatives of the Big Four firms and other firms who have full-time partners and are financial instrument experts. There are also some technical groups for the insurance, financial, professional, and academic sectors, and CINIF participates. CINIF is the Mexican Financial Reporting Standards Board in these groups.
Okay, so it's quite a process, and we are very aware of the need to allow time for translation. It's often explicitly discussed at the board table when we're determining the appropriate comment period, because we know those situations are very difficult because we're so conscious of time, but we're also very conscious that we need to give people time to consult properly. One other thing I wondered if I could ask you, Philippe, while you have the floor, ask you to put on one of your other hats just for a moment. As a member of the Emerging Economies Group, I think we have a live example of where your role there is very, very important for us at the moment to make sure we really understand different perspectives and issues. And that's a series of questions, actually, that have come into the Interpretations Committee that were discussed at the last meeting on hyperinflation. Because, of course, we're getting lots of questions on hyperinflation at the moment because Argentina has just become hyperinflationary. And so it's an issue that probably GLAS has thought about as much, if not more, than others and countries in your region. And so I'm interested, would GLAS respond to the tentative agenda decisions on hyperinflation given the relevance?
Yes. Well, we have experienced high inflation in several countries, in Brazil, Mexico. At this point, we are not in the hyperinflationary situation, these two countries, but Venezuela and Argentina, they do. And we believe that, GLAS is preparing a research paper for the consideration of the JASB, because we believe that financial statements are distorted by the effects of high inflation long before we reach the 100% number that the IAS 29 establishes. We have problems, and we can have the situation of declaring dividends based on figures that are not correct from the viewpoint of high inflation. Then we are very glad that the EASB included in the research pipeline the studying this possibility to recognize the effects of high inflation. We perform a research paper, and we identify several countries that had been in the high inflation situation in the past, and they haven't recognized any impact on that, and we are concerned with that. We will prepare that paper in the next couple of months.
So this is another important role for regional bodies, helping identify issues that we should be looking at.
Do you have a question?
Sure.
We have a question that's come in for you, Philippe, which is how do you GLAS arrive at a single jurisdiction, a single view, given that you all have jurisdiction individual mandates?
I understand exactly the question.
How do you reach a consensus view at GLAS, given different countries might have different views?
Oh, yeah, well, with the technical groups, yes. At the end, we all responses have the consensus. When there is one specific country that does not agree with something, we mention that in the common letter. There is one country that doesn't agree with this or the other topic. Yeah.
All right. Now, I think now in the interest of time, what I'm going to do is, even though I know others here would have a lot to add. Do you want to add in terms of the regional perspective?
I have one other comment that wasn't the questions that Michelle said. that is, what contribution we have made in the past for the EASB. And you remember that the IFRS for SMEs did not allow companies to use revaluation. We proposed that because our stakeholder said, well, it's not fair. It's not fair that the full IFRS accept that and the other not, and there was a change on that. The other point is that according to IAS 27, on separate financial statements, the EASB allowed to use cost or fair value, and we proposed to use equity as well, the equity method, and that was accepted. And we will continue. If we identify something, we will communicate that to the EASB.
And I actually remember that. I think I was on the staff at the time. So that's a very good example of true influence coming from regions where you pick up particular issues that are important and, to Andreas's point, give us compelling arguments for why we should act. It's always helpful. Now, I think another really important role that we appreciate that national and regional standard setters are involved in is really helping us with knowledge and experience sharing. In this room, we're all accounting experts and have a high level of familiarity with IFRS standards, but there's lots and lots of stakeholders out there who don't have that same experience, and we really appreciate the role that national standard setters play in sharing experience and knowledge. And so I wondered, Washim, if first of all I could ask you to put your Chinese hat on, I guess, and talk about how, from a Ministry of Finance perspective, you work to support the consistent application of IFRS standards in the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, thank you. as we know, Chinese accounting standards have substantially converted with IFRS standards in 2005. And in 2010, Ministry of Finance released a roadmap for continuing and fully convergence with IFRS. So in order to improve the consistent application of IFRS in mainland of China, we, Ministry of Finance, have done a lot, including, beside that, at the beginning I mentioned the translation, the IFRS into Chinese. Beside that, we need to revise revise related accounting Chinese standards based on the new or changed IFRS. We keep the principle that they are in line with the IFRS, such as financial instruments, revenue, leases, and other IFRS standards, to ensure there is no differences between China's accounting standard with the IFRS. And the secondly, I would like to mention is before we release or issue the new accounting standards, we do some test, some field test to understand the different stakeholders, the major concerns on the implement such kind of new accounting standards. And after we solve these concerns, we will release the final Chinese accounting standards. And after that, because in China we have so many entities and so large, so many accountants. So from the Ministry of Finance side, we provide large scale and numerous training for these entities and accountants, let them to understand these new changes and the new requirements of the new standards. So during the implementation process, the Ministry of Finance will also product some process control to strengthen supervision on the accounting standards, because our Ministry of Finance is a government, and we have the power to do some supervision task to keep these standards be obeyed by these entities. So Ministry of Finance cooperate with other regulators in setting up some interactive mechanism to achieve supervision synergy and enhancing supervising effect. And during the implementation, our MOF exchange views regularly with the ISB, the board member or technical staff, if we have some concern from the stakeholders. And we also coordinate and support ISB do some outreach in mainland of China and convey the discuss these issues we have met or face. And also we would like to let ISB know what kind of issue we have met when we implementing these standards. Timely feedback to ISB, yeah. And also we, because China is a member of AOSSG, now currently we are the chair of AOSSG, so we also share these issues or maybe some problems we met among our AOSSG members. For example, just now I would like to say something continue the Philips just now, the regional something, because we are leading some working group, so we use teleconference, or maybe before the annual meeting, we hold the working group conference, and also we have, our AOSSG has set up a protocol for the working group. We have a very, very clear procedure how to do something, so this is another, we share these things among the AOSSG platform, yeah. And also we find it's very, I think it's very, very important for us to use expertise power to help us to do some research and to do some feedback. So maybe this is some next, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Washim. And actually when I was in China in July, I saw firsthand some of the work that you did in a full day workshop that you organised on a topic very close to your heart, business combinations under common control, which was very impressive in terms of facilitating a group of stakeholders with a range of different views and bringing users of financial statements in as well. Yeah. For me and Jing Chao to hear firsthand some of the views in China, which I found very useful. So I thought that was a live example, which I appreciated attending. Now I'm going to move on and ask you about some of the workshops that you've undertaken. But before we do that, maybe if we could put up the question about whether people in the room organise training and education workshops on IFRS standards for Slido. I'd be interested to get an idea of how common that is.
So yes, regularly, yes, infrequently, or no, but maybe, well, these poor people, they can't say no unless they're going to be inspired by this conference. That's a bit of a leading question. Okay, so it's... okay, so there's quite a lot of training going on. That's good. That's very helpful for us. Thank you. Okay, so staying on the subject of education and workshops, one of the things that the AOSSG has done, I think almost from its inception, one of its objectives has been to assist with capacity building in the region for smaller IFRS adopters or new adopters of IFRS. And I myself have been very lucky twice now to go to Shanghai to be involved in one of these training events that you hold with countries like Cambodia and Laos. And so I wondered whether you could talk about the sort of the model that you've developed and how these workshops have been received.
Yeah, thank you. So China as the AOSSG chair, and we work together with other AOSSG members, especially the chair advisory council members. So we have several objectives to promote and the adoption and the convergence with IFRS, and also we promote the consistent application of these standards in AO region, and also we would like to, AOSSG would like to improve the capability of these AOSSG members. So that is the intent of this kind of IFRS workshop. So in 2017, as the one part of our mentoring program, because mentoring program is a very important event for us to improve the AOSSG members' capability. So we try to use the IFRS workshop to discuss some major IFRS, and we periodically we invited our AOSSG member to attend the IFRS workshop. However, we find some other jurisdictions in Asia and Oceania, they are very keen about this kind of event. So I think this is a good pilot for us to extend this kind of event among AOSSG members, also other non-AOSSG members. So during the AOSSG IFRS workshop, we invited our Chinese trustees and the ISB board member and other our CC member to come to the IFRS workshop and give these delegates from different jurisdictions update on the IFRS and also share some experience or some practices in implementation the major IFRS, for example, insurance contracts and financial instruments. Because they are these minor jurisdictions very, very keen about these topics. So I think this is a good practice for us to help AOSSG members to improve their capability in IFRS implementation. Since last year and this year we continue these practices, and during we product this kind of activity, we receive the support from one organization, that is the Shanghai National Accounting Institution. They give us a lot of support, and before I attend today's meeting, the president of the Shanghai National Accounting Institution, Professor Li, told me from their side, they would like to support us continually. So they hope could have the chance to continue this kind of IFRS workshop. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. It's a very impressive facility they have. Are there some questions that have come in, Michelle, that you want to?
So there's an interesting range of questions that I'm going to try and group together. So there's a couple of questions about translation and how can we help in the translation process? But in the same time, there's a couple of questions about how can we expedite the standard setting process. And I just wondered if you wanted to comment, Sue, on the challenge between the translation process and expediting the standard setting process.
Not really, but obviously we're always trying to balance making sure there's enough time for translation, to particularly for consultation documents, to make sure that a wide range of our stakeholders can consult. But we do need to be conscious of, you know, sticking to timetables. Now, obviously, sometimes we have much more luxury in terms of time because things aren't urgent, and in other cases we have to be careful with time with things like IBOR, and I think we just have to work together to try and get the right balance and to be as proactive as we can on our side to help with translation, with drafts of documents and things to facilitate it early on. And I guess the other thing on translation where national standard setters can really help us as well is as part of consultation documents where you see us using words that are just not going to translate, the sooner you can let us know that so we can think about it in our drafting and deliberation process, the better as well.
And then there's a question about particular regional issues and particular topics, and I'm going to attempt to answer this myself. So I think yesterday Nili outlined that we would be going into our agenda consultation process, and we have reached out to our ASAF members and other groups to start asking you to think about topics that you would like to see on the agenda. So there's a couple of questions here about topics you'd like to see on the agenda. So I would encourage you to work with your regional groups to bring forward those topics so that we can get that list together.
Now, we've talked a lot this morning about the things that you all do which are really helpful to us in terms of our standard setting processes and implementation and consistent application and also capacity building. I guess now I'm going to turn it around and give you the opportunity to tell me what I can do to help you. So what can we do that really helps support the activities you want to undertake in your regions? What more, if anything, or what more that we're doing, you know, what would you like us to continue doing that is helpful? Or is there anything we're not doing that would be helpful that you could suggest to us to help you with your work?
Okay, according to our practices and also the work in the AOSSG, we think we would like to request ISB and the IFAS funding trustee to continue to support us the big event, for example, annual meeting and our outreach in AO region. And also just now I mentioned our IFRS workshop, maybe in China or maybe other jurisdictions. In other AOSSG members. So I think this is very important for us to convey our concerns directly to ISB board member or technical staff, because so many, this time, today, we have more than half AOSSG member attended that WSS meeting. So I think maybe this kind of chance for them is very rare. They could listen, and maybe sometimes during the tea break they can convey, or maybe I think it's very helpful for them. So I think this is one suggestion. Put more resources in these events. And also I think just now mentioned to the translation, I think some jurisdictions maybe have this kind of same work. We are translating the IFRS. Also in China we have set up a very high quality or high level review team to keep the Chinese version very, very exactly to express the meaning of the IFRS and let others exactly understand the IFRS meaning. So I think we can cooperate maybe in the future. The translation is also another area. Yeah, thank you.
Linda?
I would say particularly recently we have found that when we can put our stakeholders directly in touch, whether it's with the staff. So I mentioned our IFRS discussion group, and sometimes we will hold a closed session of that, not public, but a closed session of that group so that those members can talk very candidly to the staff about particular issues they're struggling with. So it's that direct exchange of, I've got these facts and circumstances, and the wording you're proposing I think causes me to go this way, and I don't think that's what you mean or want or whatever. And then I would also highlight, too, that in some particularly interesting projects like insurance where you know, it's been very helpful to have a board member come over and meet directly with the stakeholders and, for instance, in this last summer, explain why the ISB chose to take on certain amendments but not other amendments. Yep. And the rationale and the status of the implementation. Sometimes there's just no substitute for that direct linkage. And as a national standard setter, I think it's up to us to pick those times and really say, this is a time when we really need your help on this, as opposed to everything.
Yep. That filter's helpful, because obviously we'd love to be everywhere at once, but we can't be everywhere at once. Andreas?
Thanks. I don't really have much to add to what Linda has just said. I mean, obviously, we are in a very privileged situation because we are just 1 hour flight time away from London. So, I mean, we could come over very, very easily, and you can come over. I certainly can't complain to the efforts that you have undertaken, both in meeting us privately with our committees or in doing outreach work together with us. So I think we get everything that we want. If there is one wish, it's probably just stay receptive to issues, because we are probably the ones that feel the heat first before it actually comes to you. And I wouldn't say it's always regional. It could be sectorial. It could go across a number of things. If you think about an issue that has bothered Germany for a long time, which is the low-interest environment, I think it's now starting to bite in other jurisdictions as well. So we can be an early warning signal to you that something is coming, and it might affect other countries as well.
Philippe? Obviously, it's harder for us to pop over to visit you.
For us, has been very, very helpful. The support we have received from the board in the person of Amaro Gomez for many years. For 8 years, he was supporting the region, visiting several countries. Also, whenever board members visit our countries, we organize meetings with the regulators, bankers, insurers, and all that. And we appreciate very much also the support from our chairman, from Hans, who every time he goes to a Latin American country, he is willing to meet in with regulators, authorities, and all that. That has been very, very helpful because supports our work in the region.
I'm hoping also that the materials that we put on our website in terms of snapshots and communication documents are helpful as well, because we try and visit as many different jurisdictions as we can and to engage directly, but we can't always do that. So if you have other suggestions for materials that would be helpful to support your outreach, we'd, I know, always be really very interested to hear that. I haven't managed the time very well, so I'm meant to now give you guys a chance to say whether you've got a final words of wisdom for the audience. So maybe, Mary, if you could indulge us, I'll just quickly give my panellists an opportunity. Just if you have any message that you've left that you think would be important to those in the room, words of advice, a key takeaway that you'd like them to think about as they leave. While you're thinking about that, I think from my perspective, all I can do is reiterate how important you all are to us in terms of making sure that we hear about issues early on. The more we can hear about issues that might affect particular types of transactions or the way that our words are going to work in your jurisdictions when we're developing standards and not have to deal with them as interpretation questions later on, the better. And just to thank you all, because really we rely on you so much to be our eyes and ears and ambassadors on the ground, and you do a really great job. Thank you. We start with you, Washin. Do you have a key takeaway you want to give to?
Okay, thank you. So I think I would like to say, let's hand in hand continuously devote ourselves to the development of a single set of high quality and global accepted financial reporting standards and achieve the goal, great goal, together. Thank you. Yeah.
I would just say that it's important that we work together, same vein, but, you know, forums like this, or don't be afraid to pick up the phone or send an email, because quite frankly, the more I do this job, the more I realize that there's usually a lot we have in common in terms of particular issues, and two heads are better than one, so we should share those issues with each other and see if we can work together collectively.
I echo what they have said. I also say stay tuned, but also stay alert and notify everyone of issues that come up in your jurisdictions. Inform the ISB as quickly as possible if you are dissatisfied with some of the decisions that have been made, because that's really helpful in driving the project in the end towards the right direction.
And also tell us if you love it.
That was
Well, just to say that we are committed in the Latin American region to support the implementation of the IFRSs.
Thank you. And with that, thank you very much to all of my panellists.
Thank you. We're going to do a very quick change here, and let me invite Nick, Francoise, Daryl, Petrina, and Rihanna on stage. And as they're setting up, I want to comment. I thought one of the remarks that Andreas made about the kind of the canary in the coal mine idea, that if there's going to be a problem, you guys will feel it first, is melding that with Linda's comment about sharing views. If you're getting an early taste of a problem, letting us know is important. But I think we have to appreciate how much you guys feel before we do in terms of where problems will be. Andreas, I hope you don't mind if I characterize it almost as potholders, if picking up a hot and dangerous object. So the purpose of our next session, as you know, you all had an opportunity to do two breakout sessions yesterday afternoon. I hope that you found them useful and interesting and a good chance for a deeper dive and a bit more interaction. We had 7 offerings in total. As I said, you had 2 slots. So the purpose of this morning's session is to feedback on the more general sessions, to give you a sense of what the questions, the issues were in the panels. You'll hear them for the 2 that you attended, 1 or 2 that you attended, but you'll also hear them for the ones that you didn't get to attend. So what we've asked the chairs of 5 panels to do is to just come and recap your top 2 or 3 points from each of your sessions. Now, just going through and doing a who's who and what they led, I'm going to start with Francoise, who led the session on business combinations under common control. Francoise is a board member who joined us 2.5 years ago. Nick, who to Francoise's left, who I've already introduced, led the breakout sessions on disclosure initiative. To Nick's left is Petrina Buchanan, who many of you know from her work with the Interpretation Committee. To Petrina's left is Daryl Scott, a board member familiar to many of you from other years, but I think this is your first time up on the platform in a plenary session, from South Africa, very, very interested in a number of projects, including the SME standard, which is the session he led, but does have a passing interest, I've heard, in insurance as well, as well as rate regulated. So this morning is going to be a lot of the Daryl show. And then to Daryl's left, Rihanna Weissner, who rejoined us about 6 months ago and is the lead on financial instruments. So she really walked into a firestorm between IBOR and FICE and a couple of other projects in this area that we have running. So that's the quick background. And Francoise, would you mind if I started just in order of seating and asked you to give just 2 or 3 of the top messages, top questions that we heard before you start? I will say to people, we are going to try, if we have any time, to pick up a few of the questions that came in either in yesterday's update session, or if you have any questions you'd like to raise now, we'll try and filter them in after we've done one pass through the panel. So don't forget to use your Slido question submission possibility for that. Thanks. So over to you, Francoise.
Thank you, Mary, and good morning, everyone. I mean, let me first very briefly set the context for the 2 questions that arose in our sessions on business combination and common control so that everybody has an understanding of what these questions are about. Basically, in accounting for business combinations under common control, the board has reached a preliminary view that either the predecessor method or the acquisition method should apply, and that the acquisition method should apply when non-controlling shareholders exist in the receiving entity, the entity that purchases the other, and this would be the case unless those non-controlling shareholders are related parties to the group or they consent to the use of the predecessor method. That's the context, the preliminary view that the board has reached. So we had two, I mean, we had a series of questions, but the two that I would like to highlight here for the purpose of this session, first was to question why the board had retained the existence of non-controlling shareholders as being the basis to decide whether the acquisition method or the predecessor method should apply. And it was suggested, in fact, that we should have done differently, that the nature, the purpose of the transaction, whether it is market-oriented, should be the decisive factor instead. So we've explained in answer to this question two things. First of all, that for the receiving entity, the transaction will always have substance because it, after the acquisition, it's just not the same entity anymore. And second, that really this preliminary view of the board was based on an analysis of users' needs, so that, in fact, the parent entity in the group does not rely on general purpose financial statements, whereas both non-controlling shareholders when they exist and lenders and creditors do. But as to lenders and creditors, an academic literature review of our technical team has revealed that for this kind of transaction, they don't need to rely on current values of the assets and liabilities of the corollary in order to fulfill their information needs. As a result, there remain only non-controlling shareholders that would be relevant in making the choice. The second question that was asked was whether it would be operational to rely on the acceptance of non-controlling shareholders to the use of the predecessor method. And our response to that was to highlight that this would work as the consolidation exemption today works in IFRS 10. So that, in fact, non-controlling shareholders would be informed that an acquisition needs accounting and asked whether they consent to the use of the predecessor method. And as a result of this, there is an opportunity for cost savings if non-controlling shareholders consent, do not object, in fact, to the use of predecessor, that would mean savings, but that there would not be an uncertainty to what accounting treatment should apply, because basically the acquisition method would be there to be applied otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Francoise, that sounds very much like the focus on some of the issues that we really spent time wrestling with at the board table, so good to hear that we're running in parallel at least. Nick, would you mind picking up with Disclosure Initiative?
Sure. So let me briefly highlight two issues that came out from our breakout sessions. And first of all, just to remind you what the Disclosure Initiative is seeking to do. It's really to deal with what's described as a disclosure problem, not so much the volume of disclosures, but making sure disclosures are relevant or more relevant than they are today. And so we have a number of projects that have been completed already and others which are work in progress. In essence, to make sure that the application of materiality is more effective. Now, here, the underlying issues are quite complex. There are lots of behavioural factors at play. And perhaps one of those can be best described as a checklist mentality. Sometimes our requirements look like checklists. Perhaps the easiest way to deal with those is to treat them as a checklist. Perhaps that's the easiest and most cost-effective manner to help satisfy both your auditor and your regulator, simply to work through the list without any particular attention to materiality. So we're looking how we can break that cycle. And I think one of the conclusions which we have reached is that everyone has to invest in that process, all interested parties, whether it be users, preparers, regulators, auditors, us as standard setters. And the message, the common message that came out from both our groups is we perhaps need to spend a little more time working with regulators. In principle, regulators have signed up to this, but in practice, will they still be the impediment to making this effective? So I think as we roll forward with our current initiatives, we need to have more of an eye perhaps to that. And the second point was really around what we're working on at the moment, our current focus, which is the targeted standards level review of disclosures, where we have drafted some new guidance for the board in terms of how it develops and drafts disclosure requirements. And we're testing those on two standards. I should say this is a test. It's a pilot. Will this approach work? And I think the feedback from the room that they welcome in terms of our engagement, particularly with users, this is being done really on the user terms rather than us going with a prescribed set of very technical questions to users. But we need to think about understandability more broadly in the disclosure space. So could we produce a single book of all of our disclosures together? Can we think about more broadly the boundaries between our requirements, between basis, between application guidance, between education materials? And in some respects, this will fall more into what Nili was talking about yesterday and the potential to us to devote resources to improving understandability. And that will be an area that will be up for discussion within the agenda consultation, which starts next year.
Okay. Nick, thanks very much. As we continue to bounce through our agenda, I'm going to turn to Petrina next for Interpretation Committee.
Yes, thank you, Mary. And in our breakout session, we both really focused on the activities of the Interpretations Committee sort of over the past year, as well as talking about some of the board's narrow scope standard setting projects that have come out of that. So we clearly had some questions on some of the individual topics that the committee and board discussed, and in fact we had quite a discussion around the deferred tax amendments that are out there. And I was tempted to continue talking about deferred tax today.
No.
But thank you, Mary. I resisted. And instead, what I thought I'd highlight is as part of the sessions, actually, we had some questions about the questions. And what that was is that some actually noted that the Interpretations Committee seems to have been particularly busy this year. So they said, well, why? And what's giving rise to these questions and where do they come from? So I suppose first, and what we said, of course, is that the committee is simply responsive to questions that it receives about applying the standards. And those questions can actually come from any stakeholder. And so therefore, neither we nor the committee actually have any control over either the nature or the volume of the questions that it receives and discusses. That is sometimes to my dismay, but that's the situation. So it's certainly right, by the way, that the committee has been busy, and that busyness has, of course, been very much determined by our stakeholders in terms of the questions that they've sent to the committee to discuss. Now, what kinds of questions will have been asked? Well, I think, unsurprisingly, perhaps many have been directly on the new standards. So there have been quite a few questions on requirements in IFRS 9, in IFRS 15, and in IFRS 16. But perhaps what is where there have been more than we might have expected is we've had some questions on older standards, but very much because of the interaction of those older standards with the new standards. So, for example, we've had questions on IFRS 11, but very much linked to the recognition of revenue or the recognition of lease liabilities. We've had questions on presentation in IAS 1, but linked to applying IFRIC 23, the interpretation on certain tax treatments. And we've had questions on IAS 23 and IAS 37, very much linked to applying IFRS 15. And of course, as Linda mentioned, we also sometimes get questions because of new types of transactions. And for example, Linda referred to the fact that they sent a question on cloud computing to the committee. So where then do the questions come from? And I think geography-wise, I can say all over. I think in the past year, for sure, we've had questions that have come in from every continent throughout the world. And in terms of stakeholder groups, again, all stakeholder groups. We get questions from you as national standard setters, we get questions from regulators, we get questions from the accounting firms, and we also get some questions directly from preparers.
Okay. Petrina, thanks. Let me commend not just you, but the Interpretations Committee that has done a lot in the last 2.5-3 years to really clear what had been a bit of a buildup of unresolved, unaddressed issues. And I think trying to keep on top of that, as you say, you don't know, you kind of hold your breath each day and come to see if questions have come in overnight. But it's been great to see, really, the committee, and because of the staff, keeping pace with those things. So let's shift over, Daryl, to SME Group.
Thanks, Mary, and good morning, everybody. So just again, to provide a little bit of context, the SME discussion was primarily a recap of where we have got to in the preliminary tentative leanings, if you like, that the board has taken as we've gone through the process of developing the request for information. And that request for information we expect will be published around about the end of this year. So this was really more of a looking over what decisions have already been taken. I think it was interesting in terms of the questions we asked, and when we did the presentation, we specifically split into what I call two areas, the strategic decisions around scope and alignment, and then the specific issues, the specific elements of IFRS for SMEs that we were proposing to consider as part of this RFI. In the strategic area, I think that's probably where the real questions arose from during the discussion. I would say that there was mixed support for the board decision not to change the scope of IFRS for SMEs. I think in the second session in particular, we were about 50-50 in terms of people supporting the idea of expanding the scope or supporting the idea of keeping the scope the same. On the second strategic issue, which is the idea of the extent to which IFRS for SMEs should be aligned with full IFRS, I'd say in that area there was probably what I term cautious support. We had a support for the overall principle of alignment, but a lot of caution expressed in the room about making sure that that didn't result in a much longer IFRS for SMEs, or that we didn't end up importing a lot of complexity into the IFRS for SMEs standard. And then I think there were a couple of very specific issues, and it was an opportunity for us to remind the audience that the RFI will give people the opportunity to raise particular issues, to raise concerns that they have. But we had some discussion around cryptocurrencies. We had some discussion around alignment with IFRS 9 and what alignment with IFRS 9 means. And we had a little bit of a question around whether or not undue cost and effort is as successful a tool in the IFRS for SME standard as we think it is. And so I think all around a useful discussion with some really interesting questions.
Okay. Rihanna, want to wrap up the overview with the FI, from the FI side, please?
Yes, thank you. Good morning to everyone. In the two breakout sessions on financial instruments, we covered the three major projects that is currently on our agenda, and we started off with FIS, of course. And in terms of FIS, one of the main questions or the main points of discussion was really what the scope is for the approach that the board voted for last week in terms of taking the project forward, and what do we mean with clarifying amendments to IS 32, and how do that compare to what we had in the discussion paper. And it was a good opportunity for us to just clarify exactly what we meant with that, the scope of that approach being that we'll start with the principles that's in IS 32, and so we'll try and enhance those and not really put ourselves in the minds of the board that wrote, exceptions like fix for fix and those kind of things, but what do we think that means? And then when you look at certain criteria, what does meet the criteria for equity accounting? And so that is what we plan to do for IS 32. Of course, we'll use some of the learnings we've got from the discussion paper and some of the feedback we received on that, because it does relate to what is in IS 32 today. But our starting point will be IS 32 and not necessarily the timing and the amount feature that we had in the discussion paper. And also related really to FIS was a question around whether we will align to the work being done by the disclosure initiative and in coming up with a new disclosure under the FIS project. I think you know, the message very much is that we will stay close to whatever work is being done there, and any new disclosures that do come out of the FICE project will align to that, and so it will be more objective-based rather than just a checklist of disclosures, but we'll stay in touch with that team. The second topic we've discussed was, of course, IBOR, and we did give a recap on the amendments that was published last week and really what we were trying to achieve with the amendments, but most of the questions were around phase two and, you know, specifically the timing of phase two, so how quick do the board want to address those issues and what's the timing of maybe the publication of the next exposure draft, but also in terms of questions around, for example, modifications. We know there's a lot of questions about that people have about how do you apply modifications, what is a modification, and when is that a substantive modification that results in derecognition. And so although we might want to address all of those questions as part of phase two, we have to keep in mind that phase two is quite urgent. We don't have that much time to get through all of the deliberations on phase two because the contracts are being amended, and so we'll have to balance, you know, being as helpful as we can and maybe coming up with some principle guidance that we can include in the standard, but maybe not addressing all of the practice issues we've got at the moment, to just keep in mind that you know, the need for getting the next batch of clarifications out in terms of IBOR.
So you have to walk that very fine balance between being as comprehensive as possible, yes, and being as fast as possible.
Yes.
But otherwise, no stress.
Yes.
Okay. Listen, we don't have a lot of time after that run-through, and I hope that's been helpful in giving you a flavor of the questions that came in. If anybody has any urgent questions that you want us to try and answer, quick, type them in Slido. I'm going to try and pick up one that came in yesterday's update session, and I may have some board members leaping up from the floor to supplement or amend. We had a couple of questions yesterday in the general update session about Islamic finance and why, did we have any research projects on Islamic finance, and should we be thinking about that? And the answer is, first of all, we have been thinking about it. I want to make sure that people are aware of our Islamic Finance Consultative Group, which, chaired by Martin Edelman, works, generally meets once a year, and actually we treated yesterday's session as the 2019 meeting of that group, the breakout session. It has members from about 15 members with expertise in applying IFRS standards to Islamic finance transactions. My sense is that many of the questions are really about how do we take certain product characteristics and marry them with the requirements of the standards. And I think in terms of, is there a research question that we should be addressing? Is there a project, you know, something to think about in connection with our agenda consultation? Is really a matter of, is there something for which there is, you know, is there an area of activity? Is there a topic for which the requirements of IFRS standards are not clear? Which brings me back to a plea to everybody in this room, which is if it would be very helpful for us to be aware of and think about application issues with respect to Islamic finance products when we are developing standards that apply in those areas. So in terms of what, just one more thing that we're asking you for is when you are doing comment letters, responses to consultations, providing us with that insight and some understanding of what you think may be issues would be very helpful, because it would be better to consider it in the original standard setting process. So that's a request and a response to a bit of to one carryover question. Now, pardon me while I play with technology just to see if anything more has come in. And I don't see anything. Bailey?
Yeah, Mary.
You mentioned about specific Islamic products based on one of the comments. I just want to share that the previous IFCG meeting, we actually have a kind of paper on specific Islamic product. It's actually on the ISB website. Mm-hmm. I think we cover wakala, musharaka. So I think for those who are interested can always go to the ISB website.
So you're reminding people about the paper from the 2018 consultative group meeting, March, and that's I know it is on our website. I have a feeling it's under the Islamic Finance Consultative Group tab on our website. So that's another resource. Thanks, Nick. Okay, any last messages anybody from the panel wants to make sure we get out? Well, then I will start with thank yous not only to the session chairs for coming back today after a frantic afternoon yesterday, but for thinking about what everybody should know. And not only the people who are up here, but also the leaders of our taxonomy and Islamic finance breakout sessions and the staff who supported everybody in terms of pulling those breakout sessions together. That people work really hard to try and think about what is the most relevant information for you and how to run a session that is good for you, that's good for us in terms of understanding initial thoughts and questions. And I hope that those sessions help you to feel more confident, more focused on what you need to talk to your stakeholders about as we go into some of the consultations from the next 18 months. And thanks also to you, because you brought a lot of energy and attention to those sessions yesterday. So everybody said how great the sessions were in terms of getting lots of interesting insights and ideas. So thanks all around. Now, I'm going to just ask you to join me in thanking those on stage and yourselves. We're going to take a coffee break and reassemble here in the plenary room at 11 a.m. for a session on rate-regulated activities and then a wrap-up of this conference. So see you back here at 11. Thank you.